Hello, mead friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast. I'm your host, Brando Tice, and today Frank and I sit down to discuss the different types of honey you can use while making your mead and the art of aging your mead properly. We start off the conversation talking about the different honey varietals you can use in mead and the flavors that can be associated with them. Then we shift the conversation towards aging mead and what some of the best practices are if you're looking to age out your mead. Now let's get into it. Cheers.
Cheers, Brando.
Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast, Frank.
Woo! Thanks for being here, Brando, making this happen.
How are you doing today? It's a hot one.
It's a hot one and sticky. We live in northern Mexico now.
Oh, yeah.
It used to be Southern California, but now it's northern Mexico.
We got a little bit of that tropical weather.
Yeah, a little bit. Gonna have more of it in the future, which, you know, I'm not opposed to.
You know, it's all, as we've discussed, it's all one.
Bioregion.
Bioregion.
That's, you know, right.
We just got to embrace it.
That's right. The weather doesn't stop at the border.
What am I drinking today? What is this?
Ah, well, this is our Tepache Mill style Pineapple Express. It was a limited release that we made with Marcos, our resident artist and production assistant, who took his inspiration from his Mexican heritage and the tradition of pineapple tepache, which is a fermented pineapple drink. It has regenerative wildflower, organic honey, fermented sweet, alkaline water, farmhouse yeast, cinnamon, lime, and pineapple.
I really like the nose on this one.
Yeah. Would you call the aroma golden fruit salad?
I don't know if I'd call it that, but
like golden raisin though.
There's definitely that. Yeah, that raisiny like sweetness to it,
mm-hmm. with a little bit of like plum baking spice, like plum pudding kind of richness.
Yeah,
and then your first sip,
definitely get a sweet pineapple,
mm-hmm.
like a juicy sweetness almost.
Nice. With a fair amount of like syrupiness, there's like a right, like
heavy body,
yeah,
or thick body, creamy,
yeah, which is wild. Like, you look at it and you don't think it's gonna be that
complex
and rich and multi-layered. The visual on it is kind of dark, ambery, with some clarity but also some cloudiness, yeah, and gosh, there's so much like spiciness to it too, you know, like the lime and the cinnamon, really, and the alcohol. There's a fair amount of alcohol heat, but it all comes together.
Yeah, it plays really well together.
Yeah,
and that back end,
it's very dessert like while also being refreshing, cocktail like a margarita.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, he did a really good job with the recipe.
Yeah, it took us a while to develop it, but he kept chipping away at it, and I think we're really stoked on how it turned out.
Yeah. What honey did we use with this one?
This is our blend of Brazilian wildflower.
Brazilian.
Yeah, which is proprietary. We can't talk about that here.
Okay.
No, it took us
secret.
It took us so many years to come up with a consistent approach to production and honey sourcing, which we're going to get into today, talking about honey sourcing and the different varieties of honey that I'm excited about. But you know, 12 years of doing this, your mead really changes based off the honey that you use.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to make sure that our meads stayed relatively consistent, right? You educate your customers, you sample them on something. You want it to live within a certain band of expected flavor profile.
Mm-hmm.
But honey can change hugely, right? Like the beekeepers, if they're keeping their bees in the same spot, the nectar flow and what's blooming and what's producing nectar can change significantly year to year. And so the honey they produce can change significantly from year to year. And therefore the mead that we make from that honey can change year to year. So we started sourcing multiple varieties of honey and blending them together so that the consistency can kind of balance each other out.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like coffee. Like, there,
that's why blends are created. It's for like that consistent flavor with your cup of coffee. And I can definitely see that translating to honey because, yeah, even if you do like avocado honey every single year, that avocado honey is going to change flavor profiles. But if you have it with a blend of another honey or even a couple of different honeys, if it changes a little, that's okay. It's still going to produce whatever you want it to produce overarchingly within your mead.
Well, I want to point out that there are like single flower varietal honeys.
Okay.
And then there are like regional varietal honeys.
Okay.
So here in Southern California, where there's a lot of sage and buckwheat out in the valleys and mountains of Southern California, where a lot of people keep bees, depending on the nectar flow of the sage and the buckwheat, there can be a huge variability in that regional wildflower that we produce down here. But if you're keeping your bees on a farm where they're growing one crop or another, like orange blossoms or avocado blossoms, not that they're growing those blossoms for a crop, but they're growing those fruits for the crop, oranges and avocados, mm-hmm. and then they're working with beekeepers to pollinate those orchards, then that nectar that those beekeepers, bees will collect will vary a little bit, but if the beekeepers are paying attention, they can be a lot more consistent with those varietal honeys.
Got it. Okay.
But we didn't want to support that kind of farming with our honey production, right? This idea of regenerative honey is kind of moving away from monoculture, where farmers are tearing up landscapes to plant one kind of plant. That's actually bad for the bees because those plants are only producing nectar for a small part of the year, and bad for all the native pollinators that exist in that area because those beekeepers are incentivized to kill, excuse me, not the beekeepers, the farmers are incentivized to kill all of the other organisms that live in that landscape other than their crop producing plants.
Yeah.
So we found suppliers that are keeping bees in wild areas and producing honey, and that creates a revenue stream that incentivizes those beekeepers and those landowners to preserve that land,
mm-hmm.
which is super exciting. So getting that honey consistent, though, with the variability of nectar production based off weather, we had to blend it across multiple sites to get a consistent honey flavor profile.
That makes sense.
Cool. And
yeah, each year the blend changes a little bit, probably. Depending on,
we've been doing it for a few years now, and I've got to say it's gotten pretty consistent.
Okay.
So there's probably customers out there who can notice, but I'd say for the most part, it's really fallen. Like, I used to have to explain every batch, hey, the honey is different, so the mead is different, even though we worked with the same beekeepers in the same place. And now it's like I have to point out that we don't really have that problem anymore.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't come up naturally.
Oh, nice. Okay. So going back to where it all started with different honeys and having to explain honeys change and honey flavors change and just mead in general, having to explain that as their base sugar, what are like the common honeys used within the industry currently? And like, are there different, like, can you lump honeys into certain categories that produce certain flavors, or is everyone a little bit different? How does that work?
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, one of the exciting and really fun things about mead is that different regions have different access to different kinds of honey. And so those honeys are used in different frequencies in different regions.
Okay.
So if I were to generalize, orange blossom is a very popular honey for mead making. I know a few meaderies that use primarily or exclusively orange blossom in their mead production. It's a great honey flavor-wise, aroma-wise. If you do a good job fermenting it, it gives you so much to work with. Ecologically, I'm not excited about it anymore because it's giant monocultures where they're killing everything else. So we've kind of steered away from it, but we do have a line on an organic source, and we are working on developing that relationship.
So you have a love-hate relationship with orange blossom.
I mean, I do love it as a honey and in the base of a mead. It's just, it's sad to me that this thing that is so beautiful, if we, you know, apply Kant's categorical imperative and everyone starts using orange blossom honey, and then we're going to have a dead earth that only grows oranges and maybe some bees that make honey 1 month out of the year.
Well, then let's celebrate everyone not using
it. Yes, yes. Let's move the market towards a much more regenerative vision. So
ultimately, it is quite a little bit common within the industry. It is a good floral, fruity honey that people use.
You're going to find it a lot of places if you start looking.
And if you're looking to make mead with floral, fruity notes, it could be a good starting point.
Honestly, after your second batch, you know, like batches one and two, when you're just getting your feet underneath you and you just want to verify that this idea, you know, works, that you can blend honey and water and then add yeast and some nutrient and control the temperature, and you're going to get a drinkable alcohol in the end. Like buying just, you know, bulk honey that you can get at the grocery store to prove that model is a worthwhile experience. And then like recipe three, buying orange blossom honey, fermenting it with a white wine yeast or a ale yeast and doing temp control, you're going to get a beautiful mead is, you know, really fun to share. And you can smell the orange blossom aromas. I mean, a good orange blossom mead, it's like walking through an orange grove in bloom. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a great mead to try out varietal honey fermentation with.
Yeah. And are there any other like common like fruity or floral honeys that maybe are more regenerative or maybe like are also used commonly within an industry that you would recommend?
Oh man. I mean, I think that the cane fruit, you know, blackberry, raspberry, boysenberry honeys, if you can get those in quantity, are regenerative and that they grow wild. It's not a big monoculture. The bees are gathering that nectar at a certain time of season. If a beekeeper is paying attention and just harvesting that honey, you're going to get a very true to varietal flavor profile, which can express the fruit and this great florality. And there's almost like this green cane flavor to it that in the right fermentation profile with the right yeast and the right aging can make a really beautiful, complex, tart, but then fruity, floral mead. So if people are into that, raspberry, boysenberry, blackberry honeys can be really great. Lehua blossom from Hawaii is another great, it's like, it's floral, so floral, with this acidic backbone to it that makes for delightful meads that are, you know, the bouquet on them are really beautiful. And then when fermented well, that acidity at the end kind of cleans up the palate and creates this really complex, beautiful, rich thing. And my understanding is that Lehua blossom honey is kind of native to Hawaii. Of course, the European honeybee is not native to Hawaii, but more Lehua blossoms is good for Hawaii, is my understanding.
Okay, that's cool. And like, are all of those like, they ferment fairly easy, or are there some challenges to some of them? Or like, where does the degree of difficulty start to increase when it comes to different floral fruity honeys that you're looking into?
So that is yeast dependent. Like that's the big warning, is that different honeys and different yeasts seem to have different levels of compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the research on this is yet to be done. It's something we've talked about a number of times, I think, on the podcast and just in the mead world in general. But Ken Schramm talked about this back in like 2014 at the first UC Davis mead making course, that the metabolic pathways of the different DNA of the different yeasts seem to potentially be compatible or incompatible with different precursors, phytochemicals, you know, esters and other compounds that are in the honey. And so feeding these yeast, these different compounds can either be successful or unsuccessful, as in they'll metabolize them and make good tasting compounds or bad tasting compounds. And that knowledge is not yet really charted and graphed. And like, hopefully Mead Institute will be able to work with some research institutions and other folks in the industry to make progress on this like holy grail. And hopefully we'll be able to crowdsource it with different meaderies too, but it's a little ways down the road. But we want to understand what kind of honeys with what kind of yeast make good meads, and, yeah, and which yeast honey combinations are not compatible. And therefore, like, be able to say, if you're going to make a raspberry blossom mead, use, you know, your choices are best suited to these yeasts that we have the data on. They are compatible, and we recommend avoiding these yeast because in our trials, it's turned out that those precursors in that raspberry blossom honey have been turned into totally off flavors by these different yeasts. So
it's dependent on like what yeast you're using and like just the knowledge of like, hey, this yeast might be good with this mead, and it's just experimental.
And with this honey, this yeast might be good with this honey to make this style of mead. And that's where, you know, researching online is a really, getting on one of the message boards, whether it's Got Mead or Reddit or Mead Maker, like there are a lot of online resources to run these ideas against, and at least starting there. And if you don't see anyone saying I did this and it failed, mm-hmm, I recommend not doing it, then at least that's like a new test. And then you'll probably encounter, you know, this kind of honey with this kind of yeast is generally a good one, if not a really good one.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, moving away from floral and fruity, mm-hmm, what are the other kind of honey flavor profiles out there that one can explore if they aren't looking for that necessarily?
So UC Davis published this great honey tasting wheel, which was the result of a couple years worth of work of Amina Harris at UC Davis and a lot of cool food scientists. And I like to think of it as like you've got floral fruity on one part of the wheel, mm-hmm, and then you've got like caramel, toffee, you know, rich, dark flavor profiles on another part of the wheel. And that's another fun place to play. Like avocado blossom is almost molasses, but it does have these like, you know, dark caramel, burnt toffee, molassesy flavor profiles. And when you pair that with a yeast that's good for a dark beer fermentation, like a Belgian strong yeast, that can make for an awesome meat.
And like those aren't that common in the industry right now, would you say? Like,
I mean, avocado blossom honey has gotten harder and harder to get in bulk, so that's made it hard. But there are, like, Hydrin makes an avocado blossom mead. They do it Champenois style, so I don't know what yeast they're using, and they might be using champagne yeast. So it's an interesting mead to pick up. They boil their honey, so sometimes it can be floral and complex, and sometimes it can be a little cooked.
Does
you know,
boiling honey,
we give him the Gordon Hole at Hydrin. We give him the hardest time, and he always says that he's never going to change. But yes, it would be like boiling your grapes before making wine. Like,
okay,
it denatures a lot of the subtle aromatic compounds.
What's the pros? If I'm in issues,
he evolved, you know. He was one of the first meaderies in the country, so guy deserves a lot of credit, and a lot of his meads are wonderful. but back then, the conventional wisdom was boil your honey so that any microbes that might spoil the mead are dead.
Oh, so kind of like pasteurization.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's like for a long time. It's like 15 minutes of boiling your honey. So we don't recommend it. We don't recommend boiling your honey. And he laughs and says he will never change and is running a successful business. So
okay,
good on him. But yeah, we don't encourage boiling honey.
I mean, okay, maybe that's a podcast for a different time.
We should interview him.
I agree. That's very interesting. But ultimately, like, he does an avocado honey. that is more caramelly, molassesy.
Well, it's method champenois, and it's basically dry. So it's like drinking a champagne made from this really dark, almost, you know, caramel essence, like with some herbaceous, and then there's like a bright alcohol carbonation note, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it starts like caramely, goes herbaceous, and then this like bright, bubbly, champagne-y note.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's complicated. Can be beautiful. It can also go sideways sometimes, which I don't understand.
I just don't get it.
I don't get it, man.
I try so hard sometimes.
Well, that, the cool thing is he's got a beautiful tasting room up in Marin. And so you can go out there and taste all of his meads. And then the ones that you love, you can buy them on site. And
perfect.
Get a discount when you buy a case.
And then I'm assuming clover honey can kind of fall into that category too.
Clover, it's kind of cool. There's three kinds of clover: white clover, yellow clover, red clover.
Okay.
And they're different, but close enough that, like, you know, they're recognizable. Red clover has, white clover has this really great nuance of cinnamon, nutmeg, baking spice.
Oh, okay.
Which, if you do it the right way, in a mead,
sounds like Christmas.
Yeah, it's so good. But like, it can then go dry and turn grassy.
Oh.
But that's cool too. I mean, it's just if you can like nail it where there's like 1 to 2% residual sugar, enough to light off that baking spice confection thing, it can be really beautiful. And then you can add those baking spices in, or some fruits like apple or orange, like there orange peel. There are things that accentuate that baking spice confectionery note.
Yeah. And are the other two completely different than that?
Red clover is like less so. It's, there's a little bit of it. And then yellow clover is the most kind of basic of the three. It can be really beautiful, but it's not going to have that
complexity.
Yeah, that spice, confectionery spice complexity.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Are there any other honeys that come to top of your mind that like fit in that like caramel, molasses, that people should or you would recommend trying?
Yeah, locally in Southern California here, we have wild buckwheat, which is totally in that rich caramel. It's so cool. It's like caramel plus all these layers of like earthiness and terroir, which is really wonderful. And then we have sage, which comes from like the black button purple sage that grows out here. Gotcha. And then the white yellow sage. And those again are like this caramely back note with this great herbaceous aroma that lives on top of that caramel note. And like both of those honeys, usually we just call it Southern California wildflower. Mm-hmm. And it's like a blend of the two. And when we can get it, it is so beautiful. Hmm. And can make just awesome meads that if we do it the right way, which we haven't done for a while because sourcing it consistently has gotten difficult with the drought and the reduced production of honey with the bees. But hopefully at the regenerative apiary, we will be producing buckwheat and sage honey. But when we made meads from our local Southern California wildflower, it was, and you drank them and they were made well, it was like walking through East County, San Diego. You know, these like, how do you even describe that? It's this like musty, herbaceous smell that has this earthiness to it that's like warm and golden.
Yeah, it's like, what I picture in my head is like when you go on a morning walk in the forest or something where you can like almost smell.
Except it's the sage scrub.
Mm.
You're like going on a morning walk in the sage scrub.
Got it.
And it's in your drink. And it's 12% alcohol. It's great.
It's beautiful.
Oh, it is. So beautiful. What other caramely molasses-y ones? I mean, I think that they, you know, California wildflower can kind of fall into that. Like Southern California wildfire is more of the buckwheat sage. Northern California wildfire can really have this bright, golden caramel aspect to it. And for a while, it's what we made our something something sour out of and our California oak out of. But it got harder and harder to source consistently. And we found that if the honey had too much alfalfa in it or too much cotton or, like, you know, any one of these commercial monoculture honeys that the beekeepers blend into their honeys, then it, like, just totally went sideways and that magic went away. And so we couldn't really, like, pin our business model on a magic that was really hard to reproduce without controlling our own supply. So trying to get to that point where we can afford to keep our own bees and produce our own honey and create a consistent supply of local high quality honey of the right flavor profile.
Yeah. And then is there another aspect of that flavor wheel, or is it just mainly that's where most honey's land is those?
So then it can get weird. Like, I mean, there's animal honey on the flavor wheel. Then
animal
honey? Herbaceous or vegetal. And, like, some of the herbaceous ones can be really cool, but then they can go totally weird. I mean, Tupelo, to call Tupelo herbaceous, people would probably get mad at me. But there is this bright green kind of planty note to Tupelo, but it also has this great caramel backbone. So that's, like, a really agreeable one that people get really excited about and is a good, like, beginning advanced honey to make mead out of. Lindenwood is another one. It's, like, got these beautiful citrus notes, but then it can go really vegetal and have this intense bitterness at the end that can be unpleasant. So you got to be careful with Lindenwood, also known as basswood, which are those big, beautiful trees that grow throughout the Midwest. Like Evanston, Chicago neighborhood is, like, all those streets are lined with these beautiful Lindenwood trees and make this beautiful honey. Eucalyptus can be really intense and medicinal and menthol-y, and then sometimes it can be really good. So finding that balance is tricky.
What's the, like, wildest mead you've had from a weird honey?
I mean, Eastern buckwheat is this, like, dangerous variable to play with because it can be just pure cat pee. I mean, it can just smell and taste like cat pee. But then if you do it right with the right yeast and the right balance and the right residual sweetness and the right acidity, it can be this super complex, you know, and oak aging, it can be complex and rich, and, like, all of those aspects actually complement that cattiness, and that the cattiness makes a complexity that is, like, really beautiful. And a lot of the Polish meads are made that way.
Have you, like, had meads like that?
Yeah. And so, I've had good ones, and it's hard to find and it's hard to do, but when you pull it off, and, like, the guys that do it and win awards are, like, you know, justifiably proud of their results.
Builds your ego a little bit.
Totally. It's like, I went for it and I did it.
Have we ever done it here at GCM?
No.
Okay.
No, we're gonna do it right, man. I don't have time or money to mess around with that kind of risky variability.
Okay. But, like, that's, like, probably one of the weirder ones out there.
Oh, yeah.
Just because it can go so sideways.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. One of the weirdest ones that went well was, like, a Sonoran desert honey that was, like, creosote bush. And that was in the – and mesquite. So creosote and mesquite. Mesquite's really agreeable. It's beautiful, complex, but on the sweet floral side with this, like, nice – complex, spicy mesquiteness. And then the creosote made it, like, smoky and oily. And so our fermentation luckily found the balance point between them. And it's been one of the most expensive and popular recipes we've ever done.
Oh, really?
Which is cool. Yeah.
That sounds pretty good. All right. Well, to switch gears a little bit, but I mean, honey's related to this too, as well as aging mead and how mead can be different, almost like wine, as the older it gets. And I'm sure the different honeys you use impact it, but I kind of want to do a little bit of a deeper dive into, like, what you know about aging mead and, like, the benefits, the pros, the cons, and, like, your experience with old meads versus just drinking them right out of fermentation.
Oh man, there's so much to learn on this topic, and it's exciting to share, you know, what I know. But one thing that's cool is that a lot more is getting learned every year. Flavor chemistry is, I saw one of the professors at UC Davis say this, that like when in the 70s, when he was a young chemist beginning to focus on wine, he thought it would be really straightforward. He, Dr. Waterhouse, he said, you know, we were these hotshot chemists and we thought we would look at wines and we'd look at the award-winning wines and we'd figure out what they had in them. And then we'd look at the standard and substandard wines and figure out what they had in them. And we'd compare them. And the ones that were award-winning would have things that the ones that weren't award-winning didn't have. And then that's what we would focus our research on how to produce that. And then we would advise the wine world and then get paid a lot of money and everyone would be happy and it would be, you know, a successful career.
Wine is figured out.
Yeah. He's like, oh, you know, the pleasure of
being wrong.
Being wrong and young. And it's so much more complex than that, right? Like, yeah. Quality is so many things. And one of the biggest things that it is high quality ingredients and high quality process. Mm-hmm. And what we're coming to find out is that over time, when you start with high quality ingredients, you start with high quality process, you get high quality flavor compounds produced through that process and from those high quality ingredients. But over time, those high quality flavor compounds apparently grab onto each other and interact with each other in ways that less quality compounds don't. And so there's this book like The Science of Taste, I think, that Shram was talking about a couple years ago. This was during the beginning of the pandemic that we were talking about this. But the idea is that these food chemists have been taking flavor molecules of high quality things and flash freezing them and then observing the molecules three-dimensionally through electron
Microsoft symbol. Don't worry.
There's definitely computers involved. So they use an electron microscope and they shoot the molecules from multiple directions and they can put these models together of what these molecules look like. And the more complex and, you know, award-winning, high quality products have more complex geometry. Like the molecules are more multidimensional.
Got it.
More angles, more data and material packed into the same amount of space or more space, but like there's more angles in the molecule.
Yeah, there's more
depth, quality.
There's more
there. Like your tongue is tasting more there because there is more there.
There's more energy.
And yeah, content. And like I like to think of it, you know, over time, the acids are grabbing onto the residual sugars and grabbing onto the alcohol, and they're creating these molecules that otherwise would not be created. Mm-hmm. And so we can taste that when we age a beverage, and that sense of length that we're experiencing now in this, you know, it's multi-layered. It is lingering after drinking it because those molecules hang on in our mouths and gives our organoleptic system, you know, like when we breathe, we volatilize the liquids that are sitting in the little nooks and crannies of our mouth and turn it into a gas. And then that gas goes into our nasal cavity. And through this whole experience, I'm tasting stuff that otherwise wouldn't be there if it was not this complex and this multi-layered and if there wasn't all that information.
Yeah.
So over time, the molecules are given that chance, but there are times when it's not suited to it. Like our sours, I've found after about 2 years, unless there's higher residual sugar, but when there's lower, you know, our typical sours are less than 1% residual sugar, if not totally dry. So there's like no sugar left over in the bottle. And it appears to me that like 6 months in, they get more rich and more complex and more satisfying to drink. But 2 years in, they lose it.
Hmm.
They get kind of flat, and they're like, there's still some tartness, but the honey really falls off. And the finish gets way shorter, and the sense of balance and integration like goes away. It's like it's just this tart kind of middle of the road thing. So we recommend that people don't age our sours past 2 years, and that you drink them between 6 months and 24 months.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an interesting dichotomy right there, because like the science would show that generally if you start with high quality products and high quality process, aging it should in theory make it better, but then you have a high quality product with the sour in the process and it kind of dives off.
Why?
And it's kind of like, why could that potentially happen?
My hypothesis is too much acid.
Got it.
You know, too much acid, it just breaks it down. Whereas if there's a little more sugar, there's something for it to grab onto and integrate with. And yeah.
So like there's not balance in the sour.
Right. It's like high acid, and therefore the equation falls apart.
So essentially, according to that theory, then if you're looking to age mead, you would want to create a balanced, high quality product that isn't like too sweet or too sour.
Schramm talks about this, that like ageability is directly related to the amount of acid, the amount of sugar, and the amount of alcohol. That you kind of want a lot of all three.
Got it.
And over time, they'll grab onto each other and make new molecules that they wouldn't be able to make if one of those three weren't in balance.
Got it.
Yeah.
So the more you have of all that, the more potential there is in the long run for it to create something that's like tastes better.
Yeah. And it's got to be clean, right? You don't want off flavors in that equation. Otherwise, they have to like cram into those molecules, and you'll taste them as your body breaks them down with the enzymes in your saliva. Does that make sense? Like they'll get unlocked, and then it's like, oh, there's something burnt rubber about this. That was a mercaptan that got produced because the yeast was stressed and the sulfur molecules transformed into burnt rubber molecules.
God damn those mercaptans.
Yeah, man.
But I think ultimately, is that true for wine too? Is there like more research on the wine side of it than there is mead? Or
I mean, it's so cool. It gets really out there. Like, I mean, temperature is a part of it. Vessels are a part of it. The starting point of the wine is a part of it. And there was one wine chemist that I read a long time ago who was like, we're getting into observer effect mechanics here. Like, it's so hard to pin down these variables that the person who's involved in the winemaking and the person who's involved in the tasting are as much a part of the system as any other variable. So it's like
almost like it's hard to be objective about it when you're actually doing the research,
because so many variables have been made to get you to this end state that having a scientific method that can accommodate all of these variables and isolate one variable that you're testing to compare A to B with another batch or another process is like impossible.
That's fair.
And so it takes the science becomes a foundation, and then the art of winemaking and taking the reality that the season and the farming aspect has given you and turning it into a series of choices during your production process that ultimately hopefully arrive at the best product at the end.
But there's no 100% way for you
to pin it down.
To pin it down. No, yeah. Like, yeah, this is going to taste really good in 5 years.
Yeah. You're making the best decisions you can based off your knowledge and experience in that process.
And so when it comes to aged mead, I guess I personally don't see it as much in the industry as like I would. Like wine. I see wine, And I guess my question to you is like, is there a reason for that? Or is it just like, there's just not a lot of companies that really want to age mead and it's not something that is worthwhile or doesn't improve the beverage that much? Or what's your experience? Like, what do you think of that? Like, most mead is just like made and drink. Like,
my rule of thumb is that like a year in, every mead is better. Unless okay. It's like a session mead that's made to be drunk, you know, right off of being produced and there's not much there to age. I think even our canned mead, like a year in, gets really a lot more complex. And I mean, it's delicious and refreshing right out of the can when we produce it. But if you can let a 4-pack sit in the back of the fridge for a year, it gets really good. Like the florality of it and the honey notes integrate in a way that they're not integrated, it appears to me, when we first drink them. But that's variable too. Like we just bottled or canned a batch of Wildflower Sour Session Mead, and like the florality and fruitiness of it is way above and beyond the last batch 6 months later. So I don't know what's going on there, but I do know it's really good right now. So people should check that out.
Well, you can't.
It'll be at the farmer's market. That's right. Buy it while you can. With the industry and aging, I think there's a couple dynamics going on there. One is, you know, wineries have that business model. They expect to run that business model that they're not going to release the wines for 3 to 4 to 5 years if it's a red, and 1 to 2 years if it's a white. Whereas with mead, I think a lot of us meaderies are like, cool, all of our money is in product and we need to sell it in order to get the money to pay the people and pay the rent and expand the business. You know, so I think part of that dynamic is because we are turning over cash so much more quickly than a winery is.
That's fair. So it's like more of like a, it's just a reality of the being newer or smaller within the industry, not having the cash flow to sit on product for a long time.
I think that's one of the dynamics. I think the other dynamic is that like the customers don't know how to optimize their purchases, right? Which we're hoping to talk about here in this is like, ideally, the customers come in, taste the mead. We talk about the ageability of a mead and they buy a few bottles. Like they can drink it now, like they just tasted it. And then they can set some aside and have one in a month, have one in 3 months, have one in 6 months, have one in 12 months, have one in 16 months or 18 months, have one in 24 months. And like they can have this experience of tasting this mead as it evolves and matures. And yeah, they bought 5 bottles today, but they got to have all these different experiences in that purchase.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like 5 trips to Disneyland for the price of 1.
Do you think that's common within wine buying to buy 5 bottles and experience it like that?
Yeah, a lot of people go up to Napa and Sonoma and visit different wineries, and then they buy a case of their favorite wine from each winery, and then they have it in their, you know, wine storage area, their cave, they want to call it, or their, you know, they're people who have like wine storage lockers, right?
And, yeah.
And so they like go and pull a bottle when they're going to a nice dinner and they're like, oh yeah, this is drinking really good right now. I'm going to bring it to my friends and share it with them and everyone's going to be stoked and we're going to have like a fully elevated experience because the intention is so sincere and so pleasure focused, right?
So essentially, like, you don't think that really exists with mead customers? Like, it's not, it's a product that's not viewed the same or that way like it is wine, even though it could be.
I mean, there are definitely producers that are going that direction and consumers within those producers' audiences who get that and do purchase multiple bottles in order to have a library that they can work through time. But that's not the majority. In my experience, and we would love for it to be, but I think, you know, one of the things we're kind of understanding is like there are certain meads that are suited for that, and then there are meads that does not work with. And I think that the mead industry and the customers have a lot of progress to make together to get clear on which is which.
Got it. So it's not as straightforward as wine. even though, but I mean, there are some wines that shouldn't be aged, right?
Beaujolais, yeah. Yeah.
So you just feel like the wine industry is already at that place with its customers and the industry where like they've gone through that and Mina still needs to go through that with their products?
Totally. Totally.
Got it. As someone who has been in the mead industry for a long time, do you have a mead vault or a mead cave that you currently try really old meads?
Yeah.
And like, what's your personal experience with that stuff?
Yeah, the sweeter, higher alcohol meads age the best. As long as the producers were careful about picking up minimal to no oxygen along the way. And some people use sulfur to kind of hedge that. We don't use sulfur, but in my experience, just this summer, we opened a bottle of batch 6 Mirth in a Bottle, which we made 11 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it was the most delicious thing. I mean, it was so rich. It was so bright. And I mean, but it was also really complex and full bodied. So there's this great citrus aroma to it with this underlying honey note that was just like golden and amber and so heady, you know.
What was that compared to it 11 years ago?
Yeah.
Was it the same or?
No. So 11 years ago, it was bright citrus. It didn't have this backbone of like honey, caramel, spicy. You know, the alcohol is part of the aroma now. Like I'm imagining sniffing this glass of 11-year-old Mirth batch 6. And it was like, there's this top note of citrus and orange blossom and citrus candy. But then there's this whole nother next level of rich caramel, flan, but plus like alcohol and age, you know, like a little bit of a mustiness that was really inviting and like just made this multi-layered experience. And then you go to sip it and that unfolds into this just mouth coating, like, whoa, like you have to stop talking because your brain just gets overwhelmed by the amount of sensory information that is coming across in this drink. Whereas 6 years ago, you drank it and it was like, whoo, that is citrus and sweet and bright, and there's this heat to the finish, but it's not that level of integration and that level of layer and nuance and like deep richness that you could dig into.
And 11 years definitely had something to do with that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that mead was high in alcohol, high in sweetness.
12.5%. Residual sugar was around 3. So, you know, it would be semi-sweet per the Brewers Association mead specs. But it would be like our sweet mead now. That's like as sweet as our meads get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then that's a good example of like some aging that went really well. Have you had examples of like where aging went wrong, even though it might have been high sweetness or high alcohol or maybe not? Is there like something you experienced that surprised you, like, oh, this just got straight worse?
I mean, if you have like bad corks, that's a huge problem. You want to invest in good corks if you're going to be aging your meads. So like pure real cork, not the agglomerated cork, or at least the cork with the pure discs on both ends. You can do like the agglomerated, which is where they like take cork dust basically in a binder and they compress the dust together and make like, you know, but then the discs on either side are better than pure agglomerated cork. But a pure cork, which costs like 30 cents versus like 4 cents or 5 cents, it's totally a worthwhile investment if you're going to be, and that's in bulk, if you're going to be creating meads to age. And sometimes there's cork taint, right? VCA, which is a kind of unavoidable thing when you're using corks. Like some meaderies plan on 10% of their mead being spoiled their corks. And so they produce 10% more and run their economics knowing that 10% are going to need to be replaced.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for the customer, and then just making that really clear, like, hey, if you have cork taint, let us know and we'll replace the bottle. So my experience with meads going bad, like other than packaging failures, primarily rests around like yeast choice. It appears to me that brewer's yeast meads have less ageability than wine yeast meads, but not all the time.
Oh, interesting.
Just as a general rule of thumb. And then again, acidity, if like there's too much acidity, it'll fall apart after a few years.
So just the yeast you use, too much acidity, and then like packaging defects.
Yeah.
Are generally the three things that make it go south.
So if you're trying to design a mead for high ageability, having a bit of residual sugar, you know, 1 to 3 bricks, a fair amount of acidity, and then a fair amount of alcohol, you're going to have more chance, like those meads are going to age better than lower ABV meads, lower acidity meads.
Got it. Okay. And then is there anything else when it comes to aging that you find interesting with mead that?
I mean, oak is a really, found? I think, promising. Oh, it's a whole ball of wax, but
okay.
Oak is really rad. I mean, proper barrel aged meads that have been topped up and well taken care of can just get this layer of complexity and richness and smoothness that is beautifully suited to mead.
A specific kind of mead, or all the different flavors of mead go well with barrel aged, or
no, it's like the more caramely, okay, you know, toffee, molasses end of the spectrum seems to do best with barrel aging, because those tannins have some of those flavor compounds, especially if there's like toasted oak going on in your barrels, then those caramel notes are already kind of there, and like coconut notes and vanillin is a part of oak. So those flavors seem to play really well with that toffee, caramel, molasses end of the honey spectrum. But that's not to say that there aren't floral and fruity meads that can do really well with that. And then, you know, people add all kinds of red fruit to mead, berries and currants and that kind of thing. And like that acidity and that tannin can get softened over time with those barrel aging processes. And that can make for really complex and beautiful meads as well.
Got it. What's the best barrel age you've tasted?
Mm.
And like, how long was it aged?
Melovino did a rad, and they're going out of business, which is super sad. But Melovino did an American oak, French oak, Hungarian oak blend of a wildflower traditional. So imagine just a rich wildflower, like caramel, floral top notes, but kind of non-distinct floral top notes, caramel mead with like a white wine yeast. So it had this like kind of vinous white wine backbone. And then this beautiful symphony. I think that was the name of the brand, actually, it was Symphony. This beautiful symphony of American oak, coconut, and kind of whiskey oak notes, and then French oak, which is this like red wine kind of earthy, you know, almost like sticking your nose in one of our red oak California like oak trees.
Yeah.
There's like a spiciness to it. And then Hungarian oak has this like soft front end with this like piquant biting kind of finish.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these together with this caramel white wine florality in the honey,
got it,
made this thing that was like, dude, this is so rad. He was like, do you know how much time and effort and money it took to make that? And I was like, no. And he was like, yeah, I don't think we're gonna be doing that commercially. And I was
like, no, it's not worth it.
But you know, I don't know, I mean, I feel like sometimes one of the biggest challenges and struggles of the meat industry is that we're all trying to do so many different things. And like, if we just focused on one thing and kind of streamlined our business around one thing and got better at like the marketing and distribution game and building mead shelves where like, you know, you could be the oaked mead, you know, the oaked traditional mead, and like that's what one meadery does.
Yeah.
And then like another meadery does the sour mead, and another meadery does the red fruit meads, and another, you know, and then like a shelf gets built of a really high quality, consistent, wide variety of meads. And people who want to drink mead can be like, sweet, I mean, I get that for our, you know, tri-tip meal, because that sweet complexity is going to stand up to this roasted gaminess, you know, or, you know, roasted beef. And then the sour mead's going to go with the fish and the shellfish, and the berry meads are going to go to with dessert or for aperitivo, or, you know.
Yeah.
Like, people then begin to know what to expect and what brands to go after. And then the market grows because there's a consistency and a super high quality approach there.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's hard to focus, with meat especially, it's hard to focus on one thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think
there's so many things you can do with it.
Our sours are, I think, our, you know, our thing that we focus on. But, dude, people have been loving the sweet lately. And it's like, great, okay, well, great. It is really good. But, I want us to be known for our sours. I want our sours to create a space for themselves so that people are like, I want something complex and really enlivening that makes me feel really good and is made from great ingredients. And it's like a cocktail, but it's ready to drink, you know.
Yeah.
And I want the meat experience of 10,000 flower visits in one sip. Like, hopefully our wildflower sour can fit that niche and expand that niche over time.
Yeah. Just not over 2 years.
That's right. You gotta keep your stock fresh.
Alrighty. Well, thanks for talking to me about that stuff.
Oh my gosh, Brandon. Thank you, man. That was a wonderful journey. I hope our listeners enjoyed it. We'd love to hear what you listeners enjoy about our podcast and what you want to hear about. Spotify now has a Q&A section.
That's true.
So you can type right into your app what you think about this show. We would love to hear from you. We'd even love to just like read off emails on our show. So if you have thoughts about the mead and what we're doing here, shoot us an email at admin@goldencoastmead.com. ADMIN at Golden, GOLDEN, Coast, COAST, Mead, MEAD.com.
You heard it from Frank.
That's right. We want to read your emails and have some laughs.
All righty. Well, until next time.
Cheers. Until next time. Thanks, man.
All right. That's a wrap on different types of honeys and aging meat. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at admin@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them for you. Now here's your weekly bee joke. What's a bee's favorite kind of music? Anything with a good buzz. Mead out.